feast class on this topic of Oh My God. Were any of you present for that talk? Okay, fine. So I will take some of the points, because this talk actually is in one sense further development of the topics that I had preliminarily raised in that talk, but since many of you were not there, so I will recap some of the points as we go along the course. So in the Oh My God movie, basically four issues are talked about. Now to deal with this, to understand the seminar, it is not that you have to see the Oh My God movie. That is not a part of the syllabus. The questions that we are going to discuss are more or less universal. They extend beyond the scope of what the specific issues the movie deals with. So there, basically, one of the most strong critiques that is there is of deity worship, the idea that God is present as stone. Other critique is of religious rituals. Often they are based on blind faith and they are just wastage of money. A third issue is that there are many fake godmen who actually just use faith to fleece people. And the fourth issue is, which actually is the seminal part of the whole storyline of the movie, that is, does God cause natural disaster? Does God cause earthquakes? So, we will discuss this fourth issue primarily, and we will address the other issues also. Now, the way we will go in this seminar is that I would like it to be interactive. So, I will speak for around 20 minutes, then we can have question answers on whatever I have spoken. If you have some general question answers, I can take those question answers also. And then I'll keep taking topics this way. So, if in between the class also you have some question answers directly related to whatever I'm speaking, you can raise your hand. So, primarily, I'll use this PowerPoint also as an improvised blackboard, in the sense that I'll be typing and explain the points also through the PowerPoint. So it's not that I have a ready PowerPoint. I would like this to be a more of a question answer session rather than a class. That is the way we can make it more interactive. And so throughout the class, anytime you feel free to, if you have any questions, feel free to raise your hand. And if I am in the middle of a point, I may not address the question immediately. I will complete that thought and then we can address the question. But entirely feel free to ask whatever questions you have. So let's start with the first point about natural disasters. Now currently we have the disaster happening in Uttarachal, where Kedarnath, Badrinath, all that area is being inundated by floods, and many pilgrims have been stranded for a long time, some have even perished. So this sort of situations, they raise the question, when we see nature acting in ways that are hostile, that are devastating, then that raises the question, you know, is God behind this? And if God is behind this, then why is God letting such things happen? So there are two extreme responses to this. One is that some people believe that science has all the answers. You know, we know why earthquakes occur, because there is some imbalance in the seismic plates. And that is all that there is. So the idea that there is any God involved in it, that they say is unscientific. And the other extremist that says that God is causing everything and we neglect the intermediate causes immediately, entirely. So, to understand how things work in the world, we have to understand a triple level causation. This is the primary point of this class. You know, in this world, there are three factors primarily. They're called as alliteration, Jagat, Jeev, and Jagdish. Jagat is material nature. Jeev is all of us. We are souls. And Jagdish is the Supreme Lord. So, even in philosophy, these three factors are talked about. They talk about nature, consciousness, and the absolute truth. And science may not talk essentially in terms of absolute truth as God, but they also have some conception of some ultimate reality. So these are universal factors. Jagat, now the terminology alone is Vedic, but the thought conception is universal. So these three factors, Jagat, Jeev, and Jagdish, all three are involved in every single action that takes place. So let's start with some very familiar examples, and then we'll go to earthquakes. Now, if somebody gets malaria, now science will tell us that the cause is, there is a material cause. There's an infection that has happened because some germs have come in, some disease elements have spread, and the cause was the bite of the mosquito, leading to subsequent infection. So that is true. However, what is true or what is correct is not necessarily complete explanation. There's a difference between the correct explanation and the complete explanation. So to say that a person, suppose there is a road accident and then the wheel of a car ran over somebody and then that person's leg got fractured. So why did the person's leg get fractured? Oh, because the wheel of a car ran over somebody. That's a correct explanation. But if we want a complete explanation, maybe there was a drunken driver. The drunken driver lost control of what he was, lost awareness of what he was doing, lost control of the car, and that's why the vehicle's wheel went over a person, a passerby or a person lying on the footpath or whatever. So there is a correct explanation, there's a complete explanation. So now correct explanation may take only one of the factors involved into consideration, as a complete explanation takes into consideration all the factors involved. So there is an immediate cause for whatever happens. The immediate cause in terms of malaria is the bacteria, is the mosquito bite, which causes that particular thing. Now beyond that, are there other causes? Yes. Because, no, just so the material science and generally most of our material measures try to address the immediate cause. And addressing the immediate cause is also important. But that is not the complete solution. So beyond that, scientists may say that in a house,
stars on this topic of, oh my god, were any of you present for that talk? Okay, fine. So I'll take some of the points, because this talk actually is in one sense for the development of the topics that I had preliminary raised in that talk, but since many of you were not there, so I'll recap some of the points as we go along the course. So in the Oh My God movie, basically four issues I talk about. Now to deal with this, to understand the seminar, it is not that you have to see the Oh My God movie, that is not a part of the syllabus. The questions that I'm going to discuss are more or less universal. They extend beyond the scope of what the specific issues the movie deals with. So there, basically, one of the most strong critiques that is there is of deity worship, the idea that God is present at stone, and the critique is of religious rituals, often they are based on blind faith and they are just wasting of money. A third issue is that there are many fascinating godmen who actually just use faith to please people. And the fourth issue is, which actually is the seminal part of the whole storyline of the movie, that is, does God cause natural disaster? Does God cause earthquakes? So, and we will discuss this fourth issue primarily, and we will address other issues also. And the way we will go in the seminar is that I would like it to be interactive. So I'll speak for around 20 minutes, and you can have question answers on whatever I spoke. And if you have a general question answer, I can take those question answers also. And I'll keep taking topics this way. So if in between the class also you have some question answers directly related to whatever I'm speaking, you can raise your hand. So primarily, I'll use this PowerPoint also as an improvised blackboard, in the sense that I'll be typing and explaining the points also through the PowerPoint. So it's not that I have a ready PowerPoint. I would like this to be a more of a question answer session rather than a class. That is the way we can make it more interactive. So throughout the class, anytime you feel free to, if you have any questions, feel free to raise your hand. And if I'm in the middle of a point, I may not address the question immediately. I will complete that thought, and then we can address the question. But entirely feel free to ask whatever questions you have. So let's start with the first point about natural disasters. Now currently, we have the disaster happening in Uttarachal, where Kedarnath, Badrinath, all that area has been inundated by floods, and many pilgrims have been stranded for a long time, some have even perished. So this sort of situations, they raise the question, when we see nature acting in ways that are hostile, that are devastating, then that raises the question, is God behind this? And if God is behind this, then why is God letting such things happen? So there are two extreme responses to this. One is that some people believe that science has all the answers. You know, we know why earthquakes happen, because there is some imbalance in the seismic plates. And that is all that there is. So the idea that there is any God involved in it, that this is unscientific. And the other extremists that say that God is causing everything, and we neglect the intermediate causes immediately, entirely. So to understand how things work in the world, we have to understand a triple level causation. This is the primary point of this class. In this world, there are three factors primarily. They're called as alliteration, Jagat, Jeev, and Jagdish. Jagat is material nature. Jeev is all of us. We are souls. And Jagdish is the supreme law. So even in philosophy, these three factors are talking about. We talk about nature, consciousness, and the absolute truth. Science may not talk essentially in terms of absolute truth as God, but they also have some conception of some ultimate reality. So these are universal factors, Jagat. Now the terminology alone is Vedic, but the thought conception is universal. So these three factors, Jagat, Jeev, and Jagdish, all three are involved in every single action that takes place. So let's start with some very familiar examples, and then we'll go to earthquakes. Now if somebody gets malaria, influenza spread, and the cause was the bite of the mosquito, leading to subsequent infection. So that is true. However, what is true or what is correct is not necessarily a complete explanation. There's a difference between the correct explanation and the complete explanation. So to say that a person, suppose there was a road accident, and the wheel of a car ran over somebody, and then that person's leg got fractured. So why did the person's leg get fractured? Oh, because the wheel of a car ran over somebody. That's a correct explanation. But if you want a complete explanation, maybe there was a drunken driver. The drunken driver lost control of what he was, lost awareness of what he was doing, and lost control of the car, and that's why the vehicle, the wheel went over a person, a passerby or a person lying on the footpath or whatever. So there's a correct explanation and a complete explanation. So now correct explanation may take only one of the factors involved into consideration, and the complete explanation takes into consideration all the factors involved. So there is an immediate cause for whatever happens. The immediate cause in terms of malaria is the bacteria, is the mosquito bite, which causes that particular thing. Now beyond that, are there other causes? Yes. Because, you know, just so the material science, and generally most of our material measures, try to address the immediate cause. And addressing the immediate cause is also important. But that is not the complete solution. So beyond that, scientists may say that in a house there will be 6 people, and one person may get malaria, others don't get malaria. Now, scientists say, okay, that person was more susceptible because that person had less immunity. Possible. But sometimes we see that people who have less immunity, still they don't get some infection. Others who are said to have high immunity, they get infections. So, medical researchers themselves know that actually, we cannot just trace specifically this factor causes this thing. Because sometimes many of the factors are present and some of the diseases happen. In other cases, none of the factors are present and still some disease happens. So, the point is, the immediate cause is one of the factors, it is not the complete factor. So why does a particular person get malaria? That is not just because of the mosquito bite. That is because, ultimately, that person had done some karma, and as a reaction to that karma, that person was supposed to get malaria. So that means, that reaction, karmic reaction, is manifesting through some instrument. And the instrument through which the karmic reaction manifests is the mosquito bite. And then the development of the malaria, the infection that happens thereof. So, that means if we go backwards, the first cause is the mosquito bite, that's the immediate cause. Beyond that, there is a remote cause. The remote cause is the bad karma. And, not recognizing the remote cause makes the immediate cause often seem arbitrary. Not recognizing the remote cause makes the immediate cause seem arbitrary. Because many times now there was a devastating tsunami that happened in South India. It flooded in Sri Lanka and other parts. Now, according to scientists, when the tectonic plate shook, and that set off the tsunami, the earthquake, thereof, that set off the tsunami, the shaking of the tectonic plate is slightly in a different direction. The tsunami, instead of coming westwards, towards India, would have gone eastwards, towards Australia. So now, if we examine it at a purely material level alone, what causes this difference? There is no answer. Whether the tectonic plate shook this way, they could have shook in that way, they could have shook in that way, they could have shook this way. So, if you look only at the immediate cause, the whole system of action-reaction seems arbitrary. Actually, some people are lucky, some people are unlucky. Now, beyond that, there is an ultimate cause. The ultimate cause is the will of God. Now, more specifically, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita doesn't often use the word will of God. Bhagavad Gita is the most specific word. It is the sanction of God, not the will of God. In 13.23, the Bhagavad Gita Krishna says, Upadrishta Anumantaja, Bharata Bhokta Maheshwara. So, Upadrishta Anumantaja, overseer and permitter, or sanctioner, Anumanta, Anumati Dena, as I say in Hindi. So, it is not that God does everything. When bad things happen, it is not that God is specifically causing those bad things to happen. Some people want to do bad things, or some people are meant to get reactions to certain bad things that they have done, and God sanctions that. Just like when a judge gives a sentence to a particular criminal, the judge has nothing personal against the criminal. So what the criminal is getting is just a reaction for what the criminal himself or herself has done earlier. So here, this triple level causation, that means the first causation is what can be seen by material vision. That is, I can infer materially, that's the material cause. And the second level causation is the causation of our own mistakes. And third level causation means the cause action, the science of cause and effect connection. That is the will of God. Now all these three play a role in whatever happens. Now somebody may say, I don't believe in all this philosophy. I don't believe in all this, that there is God's will and there is past karma. I only see, I know that malaria happens because of infection, earthquakes happen because of system disturbances. What do you bring God into the picture at all? Fine, somebody can have a skeptical attitude like that, but then every attitude brings consequences with it. And the consequences of a godless worldview can be quite devastating. So why is that? Now, all the cricket season is going on. So, suppose a cricket match starts. And at the starting of a cricket match, people look at the scoreboard. And there are two teams playing. One of them has a score of 0, another team has a starting score of 200. So, you know, what's this? How is this? You know, one team has 0, another team has 200. So, when we see such a thing, there are two natural thoughts that may come in our mind. One is that the scoreboard is working by chance. So somehow the scoreboard came 200 for one team and 0 for another team. Now, that's how we see some people in this world. What am I comparing 0 and 200 to? To the way things happen in our life. Now, some people get good things, some people get bad things. If you look at it right from the start of our life, as well as the journey during our life, start of our life, some people are born wealthy, some people are born poor. Now, if only wealth is considered to be a goal of life, then some people start with a score of 0, others start with a score of 200. Why the difference? Now, everybody wants to look good. Some people are good looking, some people are mediocre looking. Why the difference? So we could say the starting point difference is just arbitrary. However, the idea that everything is just by chance, that there is nothing controlling it, just by chance the scoreboard for some people comes out to 200, some people 0. So the whole universe is like a cosmic lottery. And some people are winners and some people are losers. If you are losers, bad luck, what can you do? Now this is a doctrine of helplessness. Why helplessness? Imagine a cricketer is playing, and the cricketer hits a 6, and the score becomes -6. You know, it's chaotic. We don't operate in life like that, that everything is happening by chance. In our day-to-day life, we implicitly accept the principle of causation. Causation, if somebody comes to this room and you see the face is burnt, what happened? Yeah, because we understand that whenever there is effect, there is a cause. Now the cause-effect connection may be delayed. There will be a time lag between the cause and the effect. So, if I put my hand in fire, I feel a burn. The cause-effect is immediate. If on a cold night, I eat a dozen ice creams, and then next morning when I wake up, ice cream. You know what happens is, I feel miserable. So then the time lag may be more. Somebody may start smoking in their teens, and then 20 years later, get lung cancer. So, we operate were based on implicit understanding that effects are produced by causes, and causes produce effects, both ways. So the idea that just this, anything happens just by chance, some people are lucky, some people are unlucky, that is a doctrine of helplessness. It's like what we do doesn't count. We will do something and some arbitrary chance will disrupt everything. So that's one alternative. So when I see a starting score of 0 to 100, one alternative is that everything happens just by chance. The scoreboard is operating nonsensically. The other alternative is actually even more disturbing. That is, the organizer of the match has fixed the match in favor of a particular team. That means the organizer has made the score 200 for one team and 0 for the other team. There's the idea that God, by his own arbitrary will, makes some people wealthy, some people poor. Makes some people good looking, some people mediocre looking. Actually, if God were doing this just by his arbitrary will, then by his arbitrary decision making, it is actually even more undigestible, because if somebody is going to be so arbitrary, how can we trust a person? How can we trust such a person? How can we even relate with a person who is so arbitrary? So, actually, these two are the primary options that most people conceive of in the world. There is the atheistic option and the theistic option. And if you look at these two options, often the atheistic option seems much more preferable emotionally. Why? Because emotionally, the idea that there is a God, and that God is supposed to be good, and that good God does such things arbitrarily, it's far more difficult to accept emotionally than the idea that, okay, things are happening by chance. If I'm happening by chance, if I'm happening by chance, I don't have any shelter, I don't have any hope. But it is a little long. Now let's accept it. So these two are the only two options in the conventional theistic and conventional atheistic positions. Now by conventional theistic, I don't refer to the Indian wisdom tradition, and the world has largely been influenced by Western wisdom traditions, Western religions primarily. So, in that idea, in that wisdom tradition, there's no third alternative. But the Vedic wisdom tradition provides the third alternative. If one team is starting with a score of 0 and another team is starting with a score of 200, one possibility is that in the second innings of the match, that means the same team has scored earlier, and that's why their score is better, another team has scored poor, yes, their score is mediocre. So, actually, we all have had previous lives. Previous lives are like our previous innings, and we all have scored differently in our previous innings. And depending on how we have scored in our previous innings, we get certain starting points. So actually, if we want to reconcile the goodness of God with the evil that is present in the world, the only way to do it is by expanding our worldview, expanding our vision of life. If we consider life just to be a journey from point A to point B, where point A is birth and point B is death, then life seems extremely unfair. But when we extend the worldview, life doesn't begin with birth, life doesn't end with death. The causal chain continues from previous lives onwards into this life, and from this life into future lives. Then we can actually make sense. In fact, not only can we make sense, it also makes sense. We can only make sense at an intellectual level. Actually, it is also satisfying in many ways at an emotional level. Why? Because God is not unfair. God is giving us ultimately what we deserve. And more importantly, our progress is in our hands. Okay, I may be having a poor score right now, but I can play well and improve my score. So, if somebody is ahead of me, that is not just by arbitrary fiat, that is by God's will. Is it by God's will alone? There are two options. It is not God's will alone. God does not decide arbitrary. This is in the Christian, in the Judaic, in the other religious traditions, this has been a major problem. And that's why people, if you see in the Western world, religious faith has become eroded far more than in India. Although India is also seeing an erosion of faith. But in the West, it has eroded much more, because in those religious traditions, the philosophical depth in terms of explaining causes is not very good. It's not very deep. And the reason for that is that those religions, the revelations came in particular in social historical context, where the audience was not really receptive enough to understand elevated spiritual truths. So, I'll just take the standard examples from Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and then we'll move forward with the discussion, or to understand more in depth about the Vedic perspective. So, in Judaism, universally, this is what we're discussing is called the problem of evil. The problem of evil means, when the God is good, why is there evil in this world? And this is a problem that everybody has had to discuss, and all thinkers, all philosophers have had to discuss and struggle with this problem. So, in Judaism, it has been an unresolved issue, and there's a famous rabbi who came up with what he felt was a very good solution, a very good solution. He said, but actually, there is God and there is Satan. That is the conception in the Abrahamic religions. And he said, actually, God wants to protect us. But sometimes, Satan is more powerful than God. And although God wants to protect us, still God can't protect us, because he's not powerful enough. So therefore, when God fails to protect us, we should learn to forgive him. What should we do? So forgive God. This is the antithesis of the normal understanding of God. It is to err as human, to forgive as divine. What I call this understanding? To err as divine, to forgive as human. So now, this is not just some fringe theory. Actually, it became this, when he wrote the book, it became a bestseller. And it's quite a popular idea that God is not strong enough to protect us, although he wants to protect us. And the question is, if God is not strong enough to protect us, what is the point in worshiping such a God? So now, Christianity, the idea is that they have this symbolic story of Adam and Eve. And actually, the theory is metaphorical, isn't it? It represents how we rebelled against the will of God, and that's how we came. So Adam ate a forbidden apple, and God, because they don't, in Christianity, they don't accept the principle of karma in terms of multiple lifetimes. Because although reincarnation and soul are talked about in their religions, that reference has been sidelined because of various geopolitical issues. The mixing of religion and politics has caused that. But anyway, their idea is that actually, the problem of suffering, the problem of evil, all the evil in this world is because it's not what we have done evil, this doesn't matter so much. Yeah, there are certain God-good things we should do, bad things we should avoid. But ultimately, all of humanity is tainted by evil because Adam ate the forbidden apple. There's a story that Adam and Eve were in paradise, in the Garden of Eden, and there the snake, who represented Satan, came and tempted Eve, and then Eve persuaded Adam, and then they ate the forbidden apple. So now, the idea becomes, Adam committed a sin, and from that time, generation after generation, sin has passed down to humanity like a genetic defect. And the genetic defect is passed down generation to generation. And all the earthquakes, all the tsunamis, all the landslides, all the epidemics, they are caused because someone thousands of years ago ate an apple. So it seems an insult to the intelligence, and I don't want to be a caricature of any religion over here, but unfortunately, the problem of evil, when it doesn't have satisfactory answers, then it becomes an insult to the intelligence to believe in its explanations. And Islam, the idea is that whatever suffering and problems equated in this world, they are the tests of Allah. Now, the point of test of Allah is fine. This world is actually the test of Allah. And why are some people poor, some people wealthy? It's a test. It's a test for the poor to maintain their faith, and all the rich to share their wealth. Now that's not the principle of testing, is fine. But the issue here in the problem of evil is not the principle of testing. It is the principle of differential testing. You know, after a class, after a course, after an exam, and every student gets a different question paper. Some students get easy question papers, some students get difficult question papers. The question is not why they're exam. The question is why they're different question papers. So the problem of evil in this world is not why there is evil. Yes, there is evil, no doubt. Why there is suffering, but why there is differential suffering? Some people are wealthy, some people are poor. Some people are healthy, some people are sickly. Why is there difference? So actually speaking, when we see the world from a multi-lifetime perspective, see our own life journey as a multi-life journey, then alone can we reconcile God's goodness with the evils of this world. So moving forward, there are many variations within this, and there are many Abraham thinkers, Christian thinkers also, who have pointed out that actually the understanding of the multi-lifetime incarnation perspective is actually far more intellectually satisfying than the perspective of only one arbitrary lifetime. So the problem of evil, that is God because of earthquakes? God is not because of the earthquakes, in the sense that God does not desire anyone suffering. So the answer to give the example that when there are clouds in the sky, are the clouds the cause of vegetation? Yes. If the clouds did not give rains, then no vegetation would grow. But at the same time, so we could say in a generic sense, clouds are the cause of vegetation. But if in one field, rains grow, and another area, weeds grow. Is this difference caused by the rains? No. This difference is caused by the field that gets sown. So you could say that the rains, the clouds and the rains are the ultimate cause of everything. But they are not the immediate cause. They are not even the remote cause. They are the ultimate cause. So in that sense, nothing happens without the sanction of God. And so in that sense, you could say that God is the cause of everything. But God is not responsible for everything. It is our own misdeeds that are responsible for what happens to us. So God is responsible, we are responsible. God is responsive. That means according to what we do, then God responds. But what happens to us, we are responsible for that. So I repeat this triple level causation once again, and then we can have a question answer and move forward to the next point. So whenever anything happens in this world, we can look at its cause at multiple levels. So with respect to earthquakes, does God cause earthquakes? The immediate cause, that is a seismic quake. So that is the level of causation at the level of material nature, jiva. That is a valid cause, but it is not a complete cause. It is correct, but not complete. Beyond that, there is the cause that people suffer certain things because of their own past karma. And the karmic reaction is something which expresses itself through certain material situations. So the earthquakes are the reactions, are the way through which the reactions are coming. And then, beyond that, God is the ultimate cause in the sense that everything happens by His sanction. And this triple level causation, so the first level is actually, the idea that God, that everything happens by chance. There is no governing principle. Some people are wealthy, some people are poor, because it's arbitrary. That considers only the first level. And the first level is, things are the way they are in material nature, and there's no reality behind it. So Krishna paraphrases this philosophy, this atheistic philosophy in the 16th chapter, saying this is the only explanation, there's no God in control at all. So that, I said, is a doctrine of hopelessness. The idea that nothing is without chance, anything can happen, and everything is happening without any causal link. The other extreme is to say that everything happens by God's will, and you should not question it. We don't know why. God is arbitrary. So one is arbitrary chance, the other is arbitrary God. So now what happens is, that means, in the first case, only first cause is considered, arbitrary chance. But in arbitrary God, only third cause is considered. The first and second cause are neglected. They're not given due importance. Especially the second cause is neglected. So then what happens? Then there is, again, the very great difficulty in accepting why God would do such a thing. Arbitrary. So understanding is a triple level cause. So I talk about the second link, is for the multiple link, that is for the intermediate cause. So we do not see immediately the causes that are there, but they all bring about the reactions. Right? Different timelines, depending on the specific cause and its effect. And then we discuss about how this problem of evil has various religious traditions in their perplexity trying to work out some explanation, which is not actually satisfying. But reconciling God's goodness with the evil of this world is possible when we understand this triple level causation. So are there any questions at this point? Yes. Do we have a mic?
This fire is extinguished. Similarly, bad things, why cannot be just dismerged or cancelled by goodness? It is happening in this world.
Okay. This fire can be extinguished by extinguisher. So why can't bad things be cancelled by good things? Yes. See, now when we say about this triple level causation, this doesn't mean that we should not work at the first or second level. When we are in this world, and we want to deal with the problems of this world, we have to deal with them at all three levels. So that means, if a fire starts over here, where I'm sitting right now. Now, I could say that the starting of the fire is because of my past bad karma. There is an immediate cause also. Maybe somebody gets an injury in the material area, somebody's arsonist who wanted to do something. So there is an immediate cause. But and the other is the ultimate, remote cause and ultimate cause. So when we are living in this world, and when we face problems, we can deal with this problem at all three levels. It's not that I neglect the other levels. So there's a fire over here. First thing is, I'm outside from here, so that I don't get burnt. But then I find out. Okay, well, what caused it? I'll go deeper and look behind. Isn't it? And then further, I ultimately understand that it is a sanction of God. So it's not that at an immediate level, we should not work. In the Bhagavatam, in the fourth canto, when the citizens go to Maharaj Prithu, and they are saying that we are starving. Because the fire of digestion is burning within us, as if a forest fire is burning and scorching us to ashes. So at that time, Prithu Maharaj didn't say, oh, it's your karma, suffer now. No, he acts at immediate level. So, acting at immediate level, he arranges for Mother Earth to produce and provide the necessities of living. So we do need to work at immediate level. But we should not let the immediate level monopolize all our efforts. To think that acting at the immediate level alone will solve our problems is a mistaken logic. When I act only at the immediate level, then I don't get a complete vision of things. And I say that my leg got fractured because this car ran over. But the car ran over the leg, why? Because there's a drunk driver. So we have to look backwards. The Vedic scriptures do not reject the point that there is immediate level causation also. So the idea that our past karma is responsible, and the idea that there are certain specific material causes for things, they are not contradictory, they are complementary. And we have to work at both levels of causation.
transferable. You know, everybody has to deal with their own karma. So,
yeah, when we are coming to actually total karma, tsunami, and now we are talking about tsunami disaster. Okay. So, at this point, we are not talking about individual karma.
Okay, fine. So, there is individual karma and there is mass karma. So, now in the case of mass karma, the way material nature works, Krishna explained 4.17 Vedita, Mohana Karma Navati. And the progression of karma is often incomprehensible to finite human mind. But how it works essentially is that, at that particular point of time, all the people who, for whatever karma they might have done in their past, they are all meant to die at a particular time. And they are all brought together at that particular point, and then they suffer the reaction. So now, we can envision karma as the karmic units. So different people have different karma, and then they get a particular level of karmic units. And that level of karmic units are exhausted when they meet death in a particular natural disaster. So, in the case of mass karma, also we will see that often, there are what people call as miraculous escapes. Now, the people don't know how this happens. There are many instances, for example, the earthquake in Gojain a few years ago, and there was this mother who was nursing her baby. The baby was actually with the mouth on the breast of the mother. And some brick fell because of the earthquake, some beam fell, the mother died on the spot. And then, almost 18-20 hours later, when the rescue workers removed the debris, the baby was still there, flapping her hands and legs. Now, the baby is so tender, one blow, in order, one occasional blow can fell it, kill it also. But here, the baby lived and the mother died. Is this just chance? No, not chance. Actually, there are higher factors involved. So, those people who are not meant to die, they will be right in that situation and they will not die. And those who are meant to die, they may not be in that situation, they just come at that time in that situation, and then they undergo the tragedy over there. So, individual karma have individual effects. Mass karma has mass effects. Now, can good karma cancel bad karma? No. In general, beyond the bad karma and good karma, there is akarma. Akarma is bhakti. So, that karma is nirbhati kinti cha bhakti bhajam. It is called Dharma Samhita that just as good seeds will produce good results, bad seeds will produce bad results. But if the seeds are fried, roasted, then they are not producing results. They are not bhakti. So, like that, bhakti burns up the karma. And that's how we are protected. So, if we practice bhakti more and more, and we radiate a spiritual atmosphere, that can substantially decrease the amount of bad karmic reactions that are coming. So, at the same time, it's not just that one individual or two individuals, they will change the whole karmic situation of the country or the world. That's a substantial change. Then we'll see a change in the overall atmosphere. Okay? Any other questions? Yes, behind the room. Please pass the mic. Okay. Thank you.
Prabhuji, you said that these are karmic reactions.
Correct.
So suppose I have to say that of my previous birth, I have to suffer 10 points. 10 points I have to suffer. And I'm suffering something right now. And I have to say up to 5 points I suffer. Now I said that enough is enough. I'll do something. I'll leave that 5% what is balance. So what will be the reaction? Please? I have to suffer all the 10 or should I stop at 5 and do something about it so it doesn't suffer me?
Okay. So if I have my past karma, I have to suffer, say, 10 units. And I have suffered 5, then I try to find a solution to that. Then will the remaining 5 I have to suffer later on? See, in general, in our life, we should focus on what is the best course of action right now. We shouldn't worry about what karma is there and what reaction is coming. So, I'll give a simple example to explain this point. As I said, if the chair sets on fire, and if I think that actually the burns are supposed to come because of my past karmic reaction, so I should sit on this chair only. You know, well, if then I get burned, then the burn because of my past karma, it's my present karma. So, actually, we have to understand that karma is our... Okay, now before I answer this question, the word karma often we use in different meanings. So, there are 4 meanings of the word karma. So, unless you understand this, it can get a little confusing. The first meaning of karma is action. You know, we do certain karma, and we do certain kind of action. The second meaning is reaction. You know, I'm suffering because of my karma. What does that mean? That means I have done some karma and now I'm getting the karmic reactions. So, this is the second meaning. The third meaning is the whole system of action reaction. As is the law of karma. The law of karma, this also refers to, this also is karma. So the idea is, the last meaning is actually there are 3 kinds of karma. There is sukarma, vikarma and akarma. 3 categories of action are there. Sukarma is good activity, good action. Vikarma is bad action. And akarma is transcendental action. Action that produces no material reaction. So now among these 3 categories, sukarma, vikarma and akarma. Sukarma is often referred to in shorthand as karma. Like people do karma kind. They use the word karma in the sense of it's a one category of action among these 3 categories of action. So I repeat these meanings. If you don't understand this category, don't bother about it too much. I'll clarify what I mean and then I'll use this word. But karma can mean the actions that we do, it can mean the reactions that we get, it can refer to the system of action reaction, or it can refer to one specific category of action among the various kinds of action that we do, 3 kinds of action that we can do. So now when I say that, I say that I'm sitting on the chair that's a fire. Now it's because of my karma. That means I'm referring to the karmic reaction over here. What karma I had done in the past, because of which I was here and this place caught fire. So in general, when we face challenges in this life, because of whatever complication, if you start thinking that everything is because of the past karma, then, you know, when a mother has a baby and the baby is crying, the baby needs milk. No, actually the baby is suffering because of past karma. It cries the past karma while you're exhausted. No, the past karma while you're exhausted, the mother will get fresh karma. The mother is neglecting the duty towards the child. So, there is the whole, on one side is the aspect of karmic reactions coming to us. But the other aspect is our duty. And it is nobody's duty that they have to suffer without doing anything. You know, it is in the Vedic scriptures also described that whenever there is, for example, a disease. Now, it is actually our duty to take medicines and try to get cured. Now, if I have a disease and I don't take medicine, then it is not that if my disease gets worsened. Is it because of my past karma or my present karma? It's quite likely that it's because of my present karma. So we have to act in this life to deal with situations. If you don't, so when we look for past karma, it is when we look for explanation in terms of past karma, it is primarily after our efforts to solve the situation at this life level have failed. After our duty has been done, and we try to do our duty and it didn't work. I'll use a simple example to illustrate this. In the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first chapter, it describes how first, second, third, fourth chapter of the past time goes on. Basically, they describe how when Devaki is going on after the marriage, so Vasudeva and Devaki are in the chariot, comes out of the chariot here. And suddenly comes the hero of Akashvani and catches the hair of Draupadi and about to rip off her head with a sword. And at that time, Vasudeva is trying to philosophically dissuade
Kamsa from his devious action. And what does Vasudeva say? You know, Kamsa, it is the destiny. If you are destined to die, then nobody can stop destiny. Now, if you think about this, you could just turn the logic around and think, if Devaki is destined to die, nobody can stop. What am I doing here? He doesn't do that. Why? Why? Is it that his philosophy is made only for Kamsa and not for himself? It's something to do with destiny, it is a little bit, isn't it? The point is that destiny is always complemented by duty. In the case of Kamsa, Kamsa is giving up his duty. It is a duty to protect his sister, and he's giving up the duty. So when a person is ready to give up duty to gain something or to avoid something, at that time the person is reminded, destiny is supreme. Why are you doing such a thing which you will not be able to avoid, but you'll get further bad karma? But in the case of Vasudeva, it is his duty to protect his wife. So we should never use the concept of destiny to abandon our duty. We should never use the concept of destiny to abandon our duty. This was precisely what Dhritarashtra did. Time and time again, Vidura was saying to Dhritarashtra, stop your evil son from becoming inimical towards the virtuous Pandavas, because the resulting conflagration will burn the whole Kuru dynasty to ashes. So at that time, Dhritarashtra, seeing the seething critique of his younger brother, tries to use the shelter of a pseudo philosophy. And he says, if it is the will of almighty destiny to destroy the new Kuru dynasty, who am I, a tiny mortal, to stop the will of almighty destiny? So Vidura just smashes through his false logic, and Vidura tells, O king, destiny determines the consequences of our actions, not our actions themselves. Destiny determines the consequences of our actions, not our actions themselves. That means, destiny is not stopping you from stopping the thrust, from stopping Duryodhana. No, it is your own weakness that is stopping you. It is your duty to stop Duryodhana. Now, it may happen that Duryodhana is so evil-minded, so conspiratorial, that he may not listen to you and still go against you and make an inimical towards the Pandavas. That is different. So we cannot abandon our duty and say that destiny is responsible. Actually, we have to do our duty. So, for example, when we get suffering in our life. So, now, if we can deal with the suffering at an immediate cause level, we should deal with it. But in some cases, when the immediate cause level dealing doesn't work, then rather than just be resentful and frustrated, we can accept it and then move forward in life. But in general, we should work at an immediate cause level to deal with the problem, whatever way we can. And only when it doesn't work at an immediate cause level. For example, I'm sick, I go to a doctor. Now, some of the doctor's medicine doesn't work. Then I have to endure the suffering. I'll endure the suffering. But it's not that we don't work at an immediate cause level. So, it's not that we, if, now when I say that, this is the elaborate answer I'm giving, because the question was quite relevant beyond the specific context. So now, when I get some suffering, I don't know in advance that because of the situation, I have to suffer 10 units or 1 unit or 100 units. I don't know that. So when the suffering comes, it is my duty to try to counter that suffering in whatever way I can. Of course, whatever doesn't mean anything immoral, anything anti-scriptural. It means whatever is required in the jurisdiction of rightness. Now, even after my efforts, things don't work, then I understand it's because of past karma, and I'll be patient. And I'll wait for the karma to be exhausted. Does that answer your question? Yes. Any other questions? Yes, the mic can go there. Hare Krishna Prabhu. So we actually have to ask that what the decision I have made in the past, that I am supreme or indulgent now, so that the decisions was my free will. So I have to basically ask about the two questions about the free will. First is that free will is the authorization of the Lord, means he gives us free will. And second is, if you make level of the different working spaces, so to which level does the free will work? Because I am not seeing free will working in the cat and dog. Okay. So the question is that right now we are undergoing the results of our past action and reaction. So how does our free will reconcile with God? Is it that God's will is the same as our free will? And secondly, which all levels of consciousness have free will? Yeah? Yes. See, ideally, our free will, we should voluntarily choose to harmonize our free will with God's will. But it is not that by default, whatever we do is the will of God. Actually speaking, some people say that Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, whatever you do, you can come to me. And this is not said anywhere in the Bhagavad Gita at all. But the more important point is, apart from the lack of scripture, Srila Prabhupada pointed a simple lack of logic in it. If whatever we do, we are going to go to Krishna, then what is the need for Krishna to speak the Bhagavad Gita? Whatever we do, we are going to come to me. Why do we need to speak? So it is not that whatever we do is the will of God. But whatever we do, we are able to do it because of the sanction of God. So the difference between the will and sanction. Will means, say, what God wants us to do with God's will. Sanction means what we want to do and God allows it. Now, understand in other ways, a doctor gives a prescription and a doctor gives a concession. Now, for example, when a person has diabetes, so at that time the doctor gives a prescription. Take this medicine morning, afternoon, evening, 3 times a day. And then you stop taking sugar. So now, I can't live without sugar. So then the doctor says, okay, you can take one sweet once a week. Now, taking one sweet once a week is not an instruction of the doctor. That is the concession. The patient wants to do it, the doctor allows it. So similarly, actually, many of the things that we do in the world, it's not that God wants us to do them. It is that we want to do them and God allows us. Now, why does God allow us? Because he has given us free will, and based on our past karma, we have lesser or greater capacity for free will. That means, somebody has become an alcoholic. Now that person, because of using the free will wrongly again and again, to drink alcohol, now the knot of attachment, of addiction, between that person and alcohol has become so strong that the person, it's almost as if the person doesn't have any free will. The person still has, but a groove has been created in the mind, that is, the thoughts go in a particular direction constantly. So, in this person's case, the free will has become lesser. So it's like there's an invisible rope between the bottle of alcohol and this person's mind. And the more the person indulges, the rope becomes shorter and tighter. The person wants it again and again and can resist it less and less. So, but some people, by their good karma, they have more freedom. So our much, much lesser than human beings. So So 3.38 in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna describes three levels of covering on the soul. This is just as fire is covered by smoke. That refers to the human beings. Or a mirror is covered by dust. That refers to the animals. Or as an embryo is covered by a womb. That refers to the plants. So it says similarly, our consciousness is covered. Consciousness is already discovered. So in the lower species, actually they have, their free will is only to choose how to do eating, sleeping, waking different. When a cow is eating grass, and after it eats the grass in front of it, whether it should eat the grass on the left side or the right side. That free will it has. You know, if a cat comes out of a hole and sees two rats, one is running on the left, one is running on the right. So it can be, it has a free will to choose. Should I go to this side or get to go to that side? The cat can't think, today's pandemic is punished. So, the cat doesn't have the free will to recognize that actually we all have. The cat doesn't have the free will to recognize that it can go beyond eating, sleeping, waking, thinking. That there is some higher life beyond that. Only human beings have that. So, in that case, the free will to choose between materialism and spirituality, that is there only in human beings. But for the animals, there is very less free will. It is just to choose between different brands of materialism, you could say. That's all that animals have. Should I eat this or should I eat that? Should I sleep here or sleep there? Should I accept this mate or should I accept that mate? That's all that they have. Clear? Any other questions?
Of harmonizing with the love.
God, and these devotional activities, they are expressions of Krishna. That they are expressions of us to Krishna, that I want to do your will, Krishna. And when Krishna sees our intention, then he reciprocates by giving direction.
Now,
Srila Prabhupada did not give the principle that whatever happens, we'll keep serving Krishna. But the practice of how we will serve Krishna, that means. So, in general, we should not become discouraged in our service to Krishna. Prabhupada writes in the purport that a devotee can be perplexed, but a devotee is never discouraged. What is the difference between perplexed and discouraged? Perplexed means not knowing what to do. Discouraged means not wanting to do anything. There's a difference between the two. Perplexed, should I do this, I'll do this, I'll do this. Then, we have to pause and think, we pray to Krishna, see guidance from within, see guidance from without, from our senior devotees, and then move forward. So, devotee means perplexed. And discouraged means, devotee thinks, I don't want to do anything. So it's like if I come to, I'm going on a roll, I come to three rolls, three forks. So I don't know, and there's no way to ask at that point. I don't know which way I'm going to go, my destination. Then I'm perplexed. But discouraged means, I don't want to go on this roll. So a devotee may be perplexed. Because sometimes the situation may come in such a way that it may not be clear how should I serve Krishna. So at such times, you have to wait. You know, sometimes God gives his answers clearly and immediately. And sometimes God may give his answers after some time. You know, so, you know, sometimes we seek God's guidance and we may just not get any guidance at all. So actually it happens sometimes. The teacher's silence is also an instruction. The same teacher who spoke throughout the course in the classroom when the exam is going on, the same teacher is present, the same teacher will be silent. Isn't it? Because at the time of the test. So it may happen in our life. The same teacher is there, same classroom is there, throughout the course the teacher is speaking, but when the exam comes, same teacher will not speak. Because that's the time of testing. So sometimes it may happen that we may not get the guidance of God immediately. So then we have to go deep within and look at what we have learned and then bring that out and apply it also. So we can, we may be perplexed, but we should never be discouraged. We should find out how best we can serve Krishna through your rights or to guidance. Okay? Any other questions? Yes, right behind. Okay, free will is something which we have, and destiny is governed by karma. And what exactly is causeless mercy? Is it governed by any of these factors? No, causeless mercy indicates that there is no material cause to it. The only cause is Krishna's will. It's only Krishna's will. Now again, when you say Krishna's will, is Krishna's will arbitrary? No, Krishna's will actually generally works through his devotee's will. So Srila Prabhupada explains that how do we say that we are all trying to become Krishna conscious? So how does the soul want to think about Krishna, get to know about Krishna? So that is, for that the soul has to be fortunate and intelligent. Both are there, fortunate and intelligent. What does fortunate mean? To get the opportunity for Krishna consciousness is fortune. To accept the opportunity for Krishna consciousness is intelligence. So we need to be fortunate, we need to be intelligent. Another point to explain this is, there's free will, destiny, and causeless mercy. So, some person may be born wealthy. That means that by destiny a person got wealth. Some person may work very diligently and earn wealth. That is by free will, the person was used and earned wealth. But some person might be a beggar, and a beggar happens to be in an area where there is a very wealthy person who is also very charitable. And then, that person just gives charity. So, if the beggar consciously goes to that donor and begs, please give me, still just in asking doesn't necessarily qualify the person for getting it. So, mercy means essentially there is no qualification. So, the beggar has no qualification for getting the charity. So, the beggar just goes there and asks, and then the donor gives some alms, that is mercy. But causeless mercy means the beggar doesn't even go to the donor. When the beggar goes and gets alms from the donor, that is mercy. But when the beggar doesn't even go, and the donor himself somehow approaches and gives some charity, that is causeless mercy. So, for most of us, we did not go out in search of God. Rather, our journey home, we search all over the world. Find out a way to God. You know, we didn't go out searching for God, devotees came out searching for us. Probably somebody came to give us books, somebody came to invite us for a program. So, that is an example of causeless mercy. So, to get the opportunity for Krishna consciousness is causeless mercy. Right? Even that causeless mercy, to accept it requires some intelligence. So, then when we use that intelligence and accept the mercy, then we should make such an advancement. Does that answer your question? Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
So, the way we say that every knowledge has a reference. Okay. Every knowledge comes with a reference. So, I mean, it's like, why can't we call a person? Since the Bhagavad Gita, as per Srila Prabhupada, he says it's the essence of all Vedic knowledge. So why can't we call a person who reads, listens, and follows at least the Gita as a Hindu? I mean, you specified in one of your previous Prerana festival lectures, where you specified this, that once upon a time the Supreme Court had some, they termed the word Hindu as a person who lives in India and who's not following any other religion. So why can't we specify? It's like every person who gets a degree or qualification has to qualify a set of books. But why not the same definition can be applied to a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian?
Okay. The question is that why can't we qualify somebody who is studying certain books, certain religious books? Why can't we give them that person the name of a particular religion? Say, Hindu, Muslim, or Christian? See, there's a significant, not very big, but still significant body of people who call themselves the Hindu atheists. Now, this is a contradiction in terms, isn't it? Now, there are people who say that we are Jew atheists. Now, Judaism, the first principle of Judaism is that to follow God, love God with all thy heart, all thy soul, and all thy mind, the first commandment, most important commandment. So then, how can we have somebody who claims to be a Jew and claims to be an atheist? So we have to understand that these terms, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, now often, they are more of cultural designations or social designations than spiritual designations. Cultural or social means that somebody is born in a particular society. Somebody's born in a particular race, somebody's born in a particular family. And based on that, the person gets a particular designation. So if that is happening, then the whole purpose of the education that God is providing to us through the various illustrations is actually self-realization. To help us to come to our true identity that we are not temporary destructible bodies, we are eternal indestructible souls who have an eternal relationship with God. So whatever body designations that we have, they often block us from understanding our true identity as souls. And the purpose of spirituality is to go beyond all these designations. But often, religion, which is meant to take us beyond all these designations, itself becomes a designation. If religion itself becomes another body misidentification, another label. The Srila Prabhupada says that there is this famous verse which describes bhakti. Sarva upadhi vinirmuktam tatparatrena nirmalam. So, sarva upadhi vinirmuktam. We should become free from all designations. So, when he describes this, Srila Prabhupada says we should become free from all designations that I am Indian, I am American, I am young, I'm old, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm male, I'm female. And then all these definitions also include, I'm Hindu, I'm Muslim. These are also definitions. And these definitions can obstruct spiritual realization if we don't understand the purpose. So is it that if somebody understands Bhagavad Gita properly, what label should we give that person? That person is a soul. And the soul is not Hindu or Muslim or Christian. So now it is true that Bhagavad Gita is followed in a country where most of the people today are known by the religious label Hindus. So in that sense, when somebody asks us, are we Hindus? Well, answering that question, we understand Vrindavan, the abode of the Lord, is in the spiritual world. It is not in the material world. But if you put it somewhere on the world map, we can't put Vrindavan in Pakistan or China. The Vrindavan is in India. But the geographical contours, this is Vrindavan we put in India, but still Vrindavan remains transcendental. So similarly, the devotees, those who understand the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita and try to learn the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita, are they Hindus? If you want to put them in the religious categories of the world, we can't put them as Muslims or Christians, isn't it? So you put them as Hindus. But at the same time, we also recognize that Hinduism is a material designation. And ultimately, we have to go beyond all material designations. So certain material designations may be necessary or useful for certain functional purposes. And for that purpose, we accept those definitions. But it is really not true today that everybody who studies Bhagavad Gita, every Hindu has studied Bhagavad Gita. No. Actually, the Bhagavad Gita is the most popular unread book of Hindus. Most popular unread book. Every Hindu wants to have Bhagavad Gita. Actually, even for many Hindus, the Bhagavad Gita is more a proof of their official piety. Mujhe Bhagavad Gita pata hai. Mujhe shlok pata hai. Karmanyeva vikaraste ma phaleshu tadachana. So, it's just a proof of their official piety. It's not evidence of their spiritual understanding. That's why, if people truly understand the Bhagavad Gita, then they will recognize their spiritual identity. And for functional purposes in this world, we may accept certain designations. That is fine. We require to use those designations. But we also understand that our real identity is beyond all the designations. Is this clear? Did I answer your question? Yes. Any other questions? Okay, yes, Madhuri. Is the mic? Yeah. Yeah. So should we think that as the answer to this, we should improvise on nature by learning?
Yes.
And also, I had a question about this mosquito net will avoid malaria. So, like your answer said that immediate cause at certain level influence the remote cause, remote karma. Immediate cause can at certain extent influence the remote cause. Like, that's what
okay.
We mean, right?
Okay, I'll explain it. One more time, let's see. So, first question is about... Okay, I said the mosquito one, but I think it's in malaria. So, about mosquito net, I didn't say exactly that. If a mosquito net can prevent malaria, does that mean that the remote immediate cause affects the remote cause? No, not exactly. Actually speaking, if some person has got some bad karma, then the reaction will come. It will come in some other way. No. Some people, they have mosquito net, but sometimes mosquito gets inside the net faster than them. And then, they still get rid of the mosquito. So, that means, when we are doing our, for example, if I'm in an infected area, or an area that is filled with mosquitoes, then it is also part of my duty to protect my body. So, I take that. So, it's not that my immediate action necessarily prevents some remote cause from acting. What it does also, see, what happens to us now, is not just determined by our past karma. It's also determined by present karma. By our present actions also, we can worsen situations, or we can ease them. So when we use a mosquito net, it is to prevent any further aggravation caused by this life karma. But the remote karma, the remote cause that is there, the past life karma, that will manifest in some way or the other. So we can't change destiny by our action in this life. But our action in this life can change the manifestation of destiny. Instead of destiny coming in this way, destiny will come in that way. But we can't resign ourselves to inactivity, saying that, okay, the destiny is there. Because inactivity can also be a form of irresponsibility. And that can create further bad karma. So, this is the second question about remote karma. We don't counter the remote karma, but we prevent any further bad karma. And what is the first question? Okay. Yeah, so our nature is also created by our past karma. So then I said that life is for us learning. So should we try to act in such a way that we learn and go beyond our nature? Should we act according to our nature? Actually speaking, we have, when we talk about nature, there is spiritual nature and there is material nature. The spiritual nature for the soul is to serve Krishna. That is our natural propensity. The soul has a natural propensity to serve Krishna. But beyond that, we are covered by material nature. And based on material nature, we have certain inclinations, certain likes, certain talents. Now, the whole principle of Varnashram Dharma that is given in the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedic literature at large, it is for engaging us according to our nature in dharmic activity. In dharmic activity that culminates in devotional service, in developing pure love for God. So, if somebody has a dharmic intelligence, then that person is encouraged to study scripture, teach scripture. And that's the way the person grows. So now, when a person has a particular inclination, doing that activity is pleasant for that person, and the person is also competent in that activity. So generally that means, what is our nature, how do we know? Basically, we feel internally comfortable in doing that, and externally we are competent in doing that. Both these together, internal comfort, external competence. When both together, we can understand this is more or less my nature. And in general, the Varnashram Dharma is that everybody serves according to their nature. So, the idea is that this world is a place of problems. It's a place of problems for everyone. And the expertise of Varnashram Dharma is, Varnashram Dharma allocates to people the kind of problems that they would like to face. That means, an intellectual would like to face intellectual problems. An intellectual is told, now please go and raise funds so that we can build a big temple. Raise 50 crores. Yes, study books. Why do you want to build a temple at all? Why do you need the moderation? On the other hand, the person is of a mercantile nature, Vaishya nature. So he's told, can you please find this verse in the scripture? There are thousands of verses in scripture. How will I find this verse? He's feeling a big burden. So the person, Vaishya person, told, you want to build a temple? Be happy, yes, something to do. The intellectual is told, please find this verse. Oh, good, I will do this. So the idea is, we generally serve according to our natures. Can we change, or should we change our nature? Actually speaking, we should find out what is the best way we can serve Krishna. What is the best way we can contribute? Directly in the world of service and overall life. And we shouldn't assume that this is my nature or this is not my nature. It may also take some time for discovery. And occasionally, situations may require us to do things which are not in according to our nature. And that is also an expression of surrender. Sometimes, whenever
know there is absolute necessity, as you necessity, we can do things generally according to our nature also, as a service. But in general, we act according to our nature. That way, we are happy and we are also competent, so we are productive. We are doing things by focusing on service. You clear? Okay. About nature, also what I mean is our behavioral pattern, which we should improve, like we get angry at few things, impulsive, so that also comes from past life, so
okay.
Okay, now behavioral pattern, we talk about it, okay. See, in Sanskrit, there are two words, there is vritti and there is vasana. In Sanskrit, there are two words, vritti and vasana. So generally, the vasanas are related to lust, anger, greed, pride, envy, and illusion. And so now, the vasanas have to be disciplined and purified. Discipline means as long as I have them, I control them, and eventually I get rid of them. But the vritti are the psychophysical inclinations, they are Brahminical vritti, Kshatriya vritti, Vaishya vritti. So, that we can so easily give up. We normally serve according to that itself. So certainly, yes, if I have short temper, I should try my best to give it up. And generally, through philosophical analysis, I understand that I am not the control, God is the control. And secondly, by devotional practice, we will be able to deal with it. But certainly, we should try to, as far as our behavioral patterns are concerned, bring them in harmony with what are the expected devotional standards. And that is definitely possible by the practice of devotional service. So thank you very much. We will continue tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll discuss about another aspect of this whole discussion. Especially tomorrow we'll discuss about miracles. And does God manifest in dreams or paranormal visions? And if he does, what are the ways in which we actually judge the authenticity of this? And how much important are such things in our life? Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Radha Gopinath Bhagwan ki jai. Shri Gaur Premanand ki jai.